It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
That slavery is not dead. We think it died. It's now worse than it's ever been before. There are more slaves alive in the world today, in fact, by a factor of two, than were taken across the Atlantic Ocean in 400 years from Africa. So the statistics suggest almost 30 million slaves. Now, not all of those are sex slaves, but many of them are. If they're women and girls, chances are that most of them are sex slaves.
Charlottesville attorney Corbin Addison, author of A Walk Across the Sun, discusses efforts to shut down human trafficking for sexual servitude, the fastest growing criminal industry in the world, by heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services in the first part of a two-part presentation. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how Virginia will lose tens of billions of dollars if we do not expand Medicaid in 2014. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 174, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The expansion of Medicaid in 2014, made possible by the Affordable Care Act, would be a lifesaver for hundreds of thousands of Virginians, a real bargain for the Commonwealth, and a much-needed boost to Virginia's economy, according to a new report released last month by the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis. If our state doesn't implement the Medicaid expansion, it will not only forego tens of billions of dollars in federal funding and create a stunning new gap in coverage for hundreds of thousands of Virginians, but it also will go against Virginia's history of timely implementation of previous public health insurance expansions, said Michael Cassidy, the Institute's president and CEO. The report documents how failure to expand Medicaid would severely harm public hospitals that treat large numbers of low-income patients. For these hospitals, Medicaid helps cover the cost of caring for those without insurance through disproportionate share hospital, or DSH, payments. In 2011, Virginia hospitals received over $87 million in DSH payments. Those payments are scheduled to be reduced as the Affordable Care Act is implemented, since the Medicaid expansion is envisioned as a substitute. This could cost Virginia hospitals more than $140 million over 7 years if the state does not expand Medicaid. In addition, refusing the expansion would be a marked departure from historical practice for Virginia. In 1966, just 1 year after Congress created Medicaid, Virginia authorized state participation. 3 years later, Medicaid began covering Virginians. In 1997, when Congress created the State Children's Health Insurance Program, Virginia had already passed authorizing legislation months before, and coverage went into effect quickly for the program now known as FAMIS. A failure by state officials to implement the Medicaid expansion will also leave thousands of working, low-income Virginian families who make too much to qualify for existing Medicaid coverage, but not enough to qualify for subsidies to purchase private insurance in a costly gap with no coverage. For example, the report points out that under Virginia's current Medicaid program, coverage for working parents ends at 30% of the federal poverty limit. But eligibility for subsidies to buy insurance in the new health benefit exchanges won't kick in until people's income exceeds 100% of the federal poverty limit. The right choice for the Commonwealth is to expand Medicaid, explained Cassidy. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is 5-day pay or quit notice. A 5-day pay or quit notice is a written notice your landlord must give you if your landlord wants to evict you for not paying rent. The written notice asks you to either move or to pay rent in 5 days. If you pay the rent in 5 days, you get to stay. If you don't pay the rent in 5 days, your landlord can start an unlawful detainer action, also called eviction, in general district court. You don't have to move just because your landlord gives you a 5-day pay or quit notice. Your landlord must wait until after a court order has been issued. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's legal term of the week.
Over the last decade, legislative attempts to curb human trafficking for sexual servitude have focused on victims and commercial exploiters. At the Virginia State Bar's annual conference in June 2012, Charlottesville attorney Corbin Addison, author of A Walk Across the Sun, discussed shifting the focus to heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there, and here is the first part of a two-part presentation.
That's the thing that everybody wants to know when they confront the fact that slavery is not dead. We think it died. It's now worse than it's ever been before. There are more slaves alive in the world today, in fact, by a factor of 2, than were taken across the Atlantic Ocean in 400 years from Africa. So the statistics suggest almost 30 million slaves. Now, not all of those are sex slaves, but many of them are. If they're women and girls, chances are that most of them are sex slaves. And they're everywhere. This is a problem that touches every country in the world. And the State Department puts out a report every year analyzing every country and their response to this issue. So you can read it. It's 400 pages last year, so you won't read much of it. But nevertheless, it's a problem that affects everywhere. So my story was really meant to humanize this and give you a sense of the scope, and but also draw it back into these individual characters so you see the reality of what happens, its causes, its consequences, and hopefully embedded in the story a few solutions, and we'll get to that later on.
Thank you.
12 years ago, the word trafficking did not exist in terms of human trafficking in the lexicon of the law. It was not until the international community got together in Palermo, Italy, in 1999 to hash out a protocol on trafficking in persons that this term was even defined in the law. Before that point, there was no United States law that spoke about human trafficking. There were many statutes on the state level that related to abduction and prostitution, but none directly addressed human trafficking. In 1999, the UN passed the protocol, and of course, the U.S. was one of the first signatories. And then in 2000, and actually at the very same time that they were discussing the Palermo Protocol, the U.S. Was beginning to put together what became the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000, which was the federal law, the first law in the United States that defined human trafficking as an act, made it a crime, amended the federal code to criminalize particularly. It highlighted sex trafficking because at the time that was really what everyone was focused on in the international community. Since then, it's been reauthorized every 2 years. The reauthorization always is necessary in order to get federal funding for anti-trafficking efforts. Some of that goes overseas, some of that stays at the federal level, and some of it goes to the states. But each 2 years, Congress comes back around and looks at the criminal code, and each time there have been additional amendments of the Trafficking Victims Act. Some have addressed labor trafficking, others have addressed sex tourism of U.S. men, typically, who go overseas for the purpose of engaging children in sex. There have been a lot of different amendments. Probably the most robust was in 2008, called the Wilberforce. They called it the William Wilberforce Act, after the British parliamentarian who was instrumental in abolishing the slave trade in Britain in the 19th century. And so this act was sort of the precursor of then numerous state laws that have been passed. As of 2010, Polaris Project in D.C., which is a great organization that's really focused on the domestic trafficking issue, that is here in the United States, they went through, and they do this annually, every state in the country to look for, on a state level, what states are doing to respond to the three P's of trafficking as set forth by the federal government: prevention, prosecution, and protection. And they have, Polaris has 10 different elements that they look at: whether the state is providing education for children, that is, education for young women to make them aware of the fact that if they are in a certain age range, they are targets, and that is true for all of our daughters. If you are in an age range, and it doesn't matter if you are suburban and protected or if you are, you know, on the street, the traffickers are always, always looking for new girls. So whether, you know, there's education on the table, whether the state laws are adequate to prosecute, what whether the penalties are adequate for deterrence purposes, and then third is whether there are services being provided to victims. And so Polaris rated every state in the country in 2010. There were 12 states, they call them the Dirty Dozen, that had rated on a scale of 10, 0 to 2, and unfortunately Virginia was one of those in 2010. So as a result of this, and it was fairly highly publicized, there was a group of assemblymen and women who got together and formed a core coalition to amend Virginia's laws to make them, again, address prevention, prosecution, and protection. The challenge, and this is something that I've gotten from numerous different sources, but I was not involved in these efforts, so I can't tell you exactly what happened, but various elements in Virginia's General Assembly, and I believe it may also have had something to do with the Attorney General's office, were reticent to take an approach that some states have adopted, which is to essentially adopt a comprehensive anti-trafficking bill, essentially like the federal law, but on the state level. Numerous states have done this. California, Washington has one. Massachusetts now has one. And comprehensive laws address the whole gamut. But in Virginia, the steps that were taken were, I believe there was a consensus that, well, we have adequate laws on, at least we have sort of an adequate framework in our Virginia code, so what we'll do is we'll just amend the criminal statute. So we'll add some definition to the abduction statute. We'll make sure it will sort of make the procurement of a person for prostitution a little bit more robust. We'll create a statute that requires strip clubs to put a sign in their strip club saying, if you're a victim of trafficking, you can call a hotline, these sorts of things. And so the first year in 2011, I think there were, and it's in your outline, there were, I believe, three bills that were passed, amending the abduction statute, the procurement of a person statute, and then I think there was a mandatory statute that required DSS, Department of Social Services, to create a plan to address how victims of trafficking would be provided services under the existing regime. There was no additional funding put forth for additional social services, but there was at least this mandate. My understanding is that DSS has yet to come up with a plan, at least one that is very viable. So we're moving slowly here. But nevertheless, then in 2012, there were some additional laws that were passed. So right now in Virginia, what we have is we have a pastiche of related but piecemeal amendments to existing criminal law. Unfortunately, what we don't have is we don't have a lot of the elements that other comprehensive laws do have and that the federal law has, and we can get into that later on. But there are some critical elements that really are needed, including a definition of human trafficking. We don't have in Virginia law human trafficking defined as a crime. In Virginia, we have no data whatsoever, no data about human trafficking as a crime. How many incidents there are, how many arrests are made, because we don't have a law that says human trafficking is a crime. So the police take in a human trafficker or a trafficker, a pimp or whatever, they charge him under the existing code, and they could conceivably come up with data about those violations. But there's no way to say, well, this is an abduction, but also a human trafficking abduction. So that's one thing we definitely need. One of the things that's hard for ordinary people who have not really confronted this issue to understand is how human trafficking works. What is it? We talk about it, and we can imagine, okay, a child held captive in a brothel. But in reality, in the U.S., that's actually a fairly statistically small portion of the girls who are actually being exploited for sex. So what I'd love to do briefly before I get into what Massachusetts did to sort of respond to it, and I think this is good context, is to tell you sort of to give you the cast of characters, if you will, because the truth is the average age of girls and some boys entering into prostitution in this country is 13. So the average child being trafficked for sex is a girl who is a child in a woman's body. And of course, average means there are some younger and there are some older. For every 13-year-old girl or 14 or 12 or 15 or 16 who's trafficked into the trade in human beings, into sexual exploitation, into prostitution, there's a whole gamut of others, most of whom are men, but a few are women, who are exploiting that girl. Essentially, I call them a conspiracy of thieves. They are stealing, each of them, something, some dignity from that girl for the purpose of profit or pleasure. And it's really, you know, it can be both in the same person. It's more for profit, but some for pleasure. The average girl in the United States who's trafficked into prostitution has a history of sexual abuse. There are lots of stories of girls who don't have a history of sexual abuse, but the average girl is one who is lured, not kidnapped. The kidnapping happens after the lure is set, the hook is set, and the child responds and puts herself into danger. At that point, there is an abduction that usually occurs, but it's when the girl has already stepped into a taxi cab or met the guy at a mall or done something proactive to say, yes, I will follow your lure. Unfortunately, the first abuser, the first thief is often someone in the girl's family or immediate surroundings growing up. That creates the vulnerability. There are vulnerability because of poverty. There are other reasons that girls are vulnerable. In every case, there is a vulnerable child. The vulnerability is created by something. And then the next in line is the first trafficker, the recruiter. The recruiter is, in almost every case, an older man. They are like sharks in the water, and they are unbelievably good at sniffing the blood. That is, they, and I've heard so many stories of girls who've come out of this, and they tell the story about their recruiter, and it's always the same story. This guy made me feel like the most important human being in the world. This guy, he figured out what it was that I needed as a girl, 13. Maybe I wanted a relationship. Maybe I wanted a friend. Maybe I just wanted attention. Maybe I wanted clothes. Maybe I wanted an escape from my horrific circumstances. Maybe I wanted to feel like I could go to Hollywood and be, you know, a star. There are countless different lures that these guys plant, but they are expert at finding vulnerable girls and then meeting the vulnerable girl in the place of their vulnerability and making promises that are always lies. But the promises sound like the truth. And for a 13-year-old girl, often who's had a history of being abused, that promise sounds pretty darn good. And so that is the hook. If the hook then is set and the girl says yes, and usually the way it works is, say, a recruiter meets a girl at the shopping mall and she's with a group of friends and he's an older guy and maybe he looks kind of nice or maybe he's dressed nicely and he comes up and he starts a conversation. Maybe there are three girls. This is actually a scenario that I got from a cop in Phoenix. Maybe three girls. He looks for the one in the middle, not the pretty girl, the prettiest girl because she's used to the attention and will not buy it. And not, you know, the girl who's never used to the attention on the sort of, if you will, the low end, whatever. He'll go after the middle girl, the girl who thinks she should be the pretty one. He'll then start a conversation, and he will try to get her phone number. And if he gets her phone number, he'll call her. And then he will just basically ask questions. What are you doing with your life? What do you want to do? Who do you want to be? Letting out the reel, just letting the girl talk, and then responding like the shark with blood. Wherever there's a vulnerability, he hones in. And then over the course of time, it may be a couple weeks, the girl might be having this conversation in her bedroom with her parents downstairs. And this is actually a real story of a girl in Richmond who was trafficked in New Jersey. She was having a conversation with her parents in the house with this guy who she met at the mall. And the guy planted this lie, and she was, this particular girl wanted out of her situation, was terrified of high school. He said, "Hey, I can get you a job in Hollywood. You're pretty. Why don't you meet me at a different mall in a couple of days?" And she did. It was at that point that the guy said, "Get in a taxi cab," and she's gone. So at that point, within 24 hours, she's out on the street in Atlantic City. This was back in the 90s when actually this happened on the street. These days it happens in hotels like this, and it's negotiated through Backpage.com or through other internet sites. So there's the recruiter. Then there's the pimp. Sometimes the recruiter's the pimp, but the pimp is always the guy who takes, and it's usually a guy, sometimes a girl, but that takes the girl, gets her ready, grooms her, sometimes rapes her, does other things to groom her, sometimes gets pretty violent, and then preps her for actually being sold. And then he's the guy who's putting the ads on Backpage. And so if you go on Backpage and look, you can see in just about every community in the United States, there are prostitution ads, and a lot of them look like underage kids. Those ads are being posted not by the girls themselves if they're underage. They're being posted by a pimp. And they are designed very specifically to go after sort of the fantasies of the customer. So that there's the pimp who controls the girl. Then there's usually another woman who's involved who works sort of, if you will, kind of like a traditional madame. And usually that woman is a former prostitute who has essentially bought into the pimp's world and now exploits other girls. Typically that woman who is now overage was exploited as a minor. And so you have this tableau. And then, of course, you have today, and because streetwalking is much less common, you have what I call the institutional pimp. That is, and it's a passive thing, but it's the websites that allow the posting of prostitution advertisements. They do it passively, and they claim, and they legitimately have filters, but those filters catch a very small fraction of the number of ads that are posted, and they're making millions of dollars a year on these ads, and they continue to do it. Craigslist shut down their U.S. site, but the worldwide, they're still doing it everywhere else in the world but the United States. Backpage is still doing it in the U.S., notwithstanding the fact that most attorneys general have written them demanding that they take their ads down. That site allows pimps to immediately turn girls into transactions. It's unbelievable how simple it is. All you need is a cell phone and a car, and you can become a pimp, and you can make a tremendous amount of money. If you're a gang member, an MS-13 member in Northern Virginia, and you have a stable of four girls, you can make $250,000 a year.
You've been listening to Charlottesville attorney and author Corbin Addison discussing a shift in focus to heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services to combat human trafficking for sexual servitude. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show.
This week's top three tips are about foreclosure. The first tip is that if you're paying for a house due to a mortgage or home loan, the creditor can foreclose upon or take back the house if you don't pay in full and on time. The second tip is that almost all mortgages in Virginia are secured by a deed of trust. A deed of trust is a deed of the property from you to a trustee who can sell your property if you don't pay the mortgage payments on time in full every month. The third tip is that in Virginia, foreclosures are done outside of court rather than through the court system.
For Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Human trafficking for sexual servitude is the fastest growing criminal industry in the world because it is immensely profitable. Join us next week when Charlottesville attorney Corbin Addison, author of A Walk Across the Sun, discusses efforts to shut down this crime by heavily penalizing the purchase of sexual services in the second part of a two-part series. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.